Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with Jason Cannon, who's an associate artist at Florida Studio Theater, where he directs new play development and is the mentor for the Acting Apprentice Program, but where he also can be seen on stage, as he is currently, in the two-character play Dancing Lesson by Mark Germain. Jason's story is somewhat ironic, since he did not discover his interest in theater until late in his high school career. But once having discovered it, he held on with both hands. Listen to how he became, as he calls himself, a theater hyphenate. Stay tuned. Here come the show. Welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are. Not some version of yourself which you think is the one that's going to bring you attention, affection, love, or the absence of criticism or punishment, but the person you really are. I'm a psychotherapist, and every day I meet people who are living out what I call their cover story. This is the truth about them. It's just not the whole truth about them. Because it is my belief that so many of us have been forced in our childhood to deny important pieces of ourselves. What we think, how we act, what we like, what we're drawn to. Because those things simply didn't fit with our family of origin, or they weren't like the other kids at school, or some teacher didn't like it, or it went against some religious tenet or cultural tenet. And so we were told that that was not okay, in one way or another, we got the message that being that way, thinking that way, liking that thing was not okay. Well, kids cannot really survive continually presenting a version of themselves that doesn't go down well in important sectors of their lives. So we have clever unconsciouses which help us first pretend, hide, and then forget. We forget that we ever had these instincts, these impulses, these ideas, that we were ever drawn to these activities, these skills, these talents. And so we come into adulthood with a sort of limited version of who we are. The good news is that those things that we learned to deny and finally forget, we didn't lose them. They have gone what I call undercover. They're still there, waiting for us to remember, recapture, use, be all that we are. In my show, I play interviews with people who make their living or their life with an art. In this culture, we make it very difficult for people to dedicate their life, never mind make a living, with an art. So the people who do it because they can't help it. It is really who they are. And when you listen to them, you can hear it. It's glaring that what you hear is what there is, at least in the area of their work. Today, I'm airing an interview, as I said in the run-up, with Jason Cannon. And Jason is interesting because, as I said in the run-up, he did not discover his interest in theater until he was in high school. And then he had luck. He had a teacher who, as he said, saw through his disguise, and put him in forensics, where he came in contact with the theater kids. And once that happened, the real Jason emerged, and he has dedicated his life to being able to do everything that can be done in the theater. Currently, he's working at FST as an associate artist, but he also gets an opportunity to be on stage as he is now in the production of Marc Germain's Dancing Lesson. Listen to Jason talk about his life. Listen to the energy, the passion, the commitment, the delight, and you will hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. So, with no further ado, here now, Jason Cannon. Okay, so I'm here with Jason Cannon in a rehearsal space at Florida Studio Theater, and I am talking to Jason because he is here in the ensemble cast.
Ensemble, yes.
Yes, the two-person
the
cast.
The two-hander ensemble.
Exactly right, of Dancing Lessons.
Yes.
Which I saw and was quite impressed by.
Oh, thank you very much.
Well, you're very welcome. And I want to talk about Dancing Lessons, so anybody who hasn't seen it will have a reason to come down and see it.
Great.
But before I do that,
okay,
I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Oh, fantastic.
And you are clearly doing that.
Quite fortunately so, yes.
Yes, okay. I'm making the assumption that the art to which you have given your life is acting? Theater?
Theater as a whole. I am a multi-hyphenate.
Are you? Yeah, well, give me the hyphen.
I'm a union actor. I'm a union director. I'm also in SAG-AFTRA. I'm also a produced playwright. I direct new play development here at FST. I am an educator. I've taught everything from grade school and camps up through university-level classes. I am the mentor for the Acting Apprentice program here, so I seek out apprentices and interns and mentor them and teach them and set up workshops for them. And
oh, my goodness.
One of the reasons I was hired is because my skill set is quite disparate. I have stage management credits. I have design credits.
You don't look old enough for this.
Oh, that's very kind.
I mean, really, when did you have the time to...
Well, I learned early on as an actor, you can't control who the director casts, and you can't control what the producer produces. So I just kept kind of working my way up to becoming a director, and then a writer, and then a producer.
You just figured that you would do all these things.
The more hats you wear, the more often you get hired. I just really didn't have any patience or desire to do anything else but theater. Every job I have ever had since I graduated college has been theater in some way. Acting, directing, writing, teaching. I just refuse to do anything else.
Okay, good. So, this is my question.
Please.
Do you remember, can you tell me, when was the very first moment in your life when this thing about theater, about acting, about performing, if you can remember when that was, can you tell me?
Yes, it was high school.
High school? Wait, that's kind of late.
It can be. We moved a lot when I was a kid, so it was just pretty much my brother and me and my parents. We just moved a lot for various reasons. And I was always very academically inclined. I would fight for straight A's all the time. I was especially good at math.
Who would have thought?
Which is strange, right?
Take me there. You're
sure,
in high school.
Sure. And we moved again after my freshman year in high school. And we ended up at Lafayette Jefferson High School in Indiana. And I'm sitting there the week before classes start with my mother and my guidance counselor, Mr. Torrance. And I had an extra slot in my schedule. And Mr. Torrance and my mom said, hey, what about forensics? And I had no class. I was like, criminal science? They're like, no, public speaking. I'm like, sure, whatever, fine. Because my grandfather was a preacher, my mom was a singer, my dad's a preacher. I've seen my aunt went to grad school for acting. I've seen my family in front of people my whole life. My mom's youngest sister got her MFA in acting. My grandfather was on a radio show for many, many years and then a preacher. I saw him preach and sing all the time. My uncle was a singer. My mom's a professional soprano. It's not weird to see our family performing.
No, clearly, but yeah. There was no hint of that for you earlier.
No, Wes and I, my brother, we were very introverted because we moved so much. We were only 2 years apart, so we were best friends. But we moved so often, we didn't really have other friends besides, and so I was very introverted in school. Another reason I put so much of my energy into my academics is because I didn't have a social life, really, growing up. Outside school and the church, I didn't have friends.
Okay, So they put you in forensics, and
yeah.
What happened?
It was like an after-school special, Lynn. I met Mrs. Walker. this wonderful, wonderful woman and teacher, and who just kind of saw through my insecurity, who saw through my two-facedness, my insecurity of not knowing anyone, but also my kind of front of ego I would put out as the smartest kid in the class, because that was my identity. That's all I had.
Right.
She saw through and kind of plucked me out and said, all right, as part of this class, everyone in forensics class had to join the speech team. And so I started writing speeches and learning speeches and going to speech tournaments. And through the speech team, I met the theater kids. And by junior year, I was auditioning for my first show ever.
Wow.
It was Cyrano de Bergerac. I played Linier, the drunk poet, and soldier number 87 who dies at the wall or whatever. But
so
it was a thing.
So you got cast in your first role in
yes.
your first audition?
Well, again, this is a high school. It was a big theater department, but they're doing Cyrano. They need a lot of bodies. I'm tall.
Yes, and you have a big voice.
I have a big voice. There was a lot of sword fighting. I was athletic.
Yes.
So, and I was considered for both Cyrano and Christian, but Mr. Prill, lovely man, had never seen me perform before, and wasn't about to, you know, slight the president of the drama club who was a senior for some, you know, nameless junior coming in for his first show. And I was pleased, I was just excited to be part of it. Suddenly I had this social life, I had this built-in group of friends, I had this sense of doing something that people, it was fun, it was art, it was, I mean, as much as art can be in a high school environment. And it really, you know, you walk into that stage for the first time and have that smell, the sawdust and the face paint and all, you know, all the cliches, the smell, I was hooked, I was done.
Yeah.
So I got into it sophomore year through the speech kids, but the theater kids, because they overlapped a lot. And then continued with both theater and speech through the rest of high school. Almost all my friends were involved somehow in those two arenas. Went and majored in college in theater.
Hold on. Yeah. So at some point, you decided that you weren't going to follow some kind of academic career, you weren't going to be a mathematician, you weren't going to be a teacher. So when did you decide? Do you know? Do you remember?
I was still driving hard at the academics. It was still a big part of my identity. I was valedictorian. I had a 4.0.
Yeah.
I still
right,
invested
right.
like crazy in that, because this was still relatively new. In college, I still, up to my senior year, didn't know if I would go to grad school in creative
writing.
Well,
wait a minute. What did you major in?
In English and theater, double major.
So already, by the time you were going to college, you had somehow made up your mind that, I mean, you were...
Yeah, theater was very important. The liberal arts. I went to a liberal arts school. Mm-hmm. The humanities were my bread and butter. I still took classes like general physics and aced them just because... It's weird. I work the math part of my mind, and it kind of lets the artistic part of my mind rest.
Fallow.
Exactly. Fallow ground. And also, there's a precision in math that you don't really get in art, which is kind of refreshing. That semicolon is off. That's why it doesn't work. Oh, I fixed it. I fixed it. There's no fixing it in an essay. You can't get an essay perfect.
No. Hold on. So, this is what I hear. I hear you're in college and you're having the time of your life. You're majoring in these things that you love. You're getting the science fix, right? But have you thought what I'm going to do for my career, for my life, or you haven't thought about that?
No, it's just in college I was just experiencing it, doing shows, taking Shakespeare, writing paper. And again, like I said, senior year I was like, do I go to grad school to write or go to grad school to do theater? It was one or the other. I spent a semester my junior year actually out in Hollywood at a film school. A lot of it overlapped, but I didn't know if I wanted, and what ultimately happened is that the solitary life of the writer kind of would not have been healthy for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I need my alone time, but the social, like I talked about growing up the way I did, the social aspect of theater was like breathing.
Yeah. It was feeding something in you that
yes.
you needed.
Yes.
Right. And so you knew that.
I don't know that I could have said that then.
Right.
Looking back, I think that's why I started to drift a certain way. I stayed in Greenville, this little town where my college was, about an hour from St. Louis, because my brother was still at college there. And I started driving to St. Louis to audition. I had a job on campus in the registrar's office, and I wasn't sure. I ended up doing some substitute teaching. I got hired to direct a high school production of Romeo and Juliet there in town. I was auditioning for community theater shows. I was clueless, Lynn. I had no idea. I hadn't gone to conservatory. I started, like you said, theater. I came to it late. I didn't know every Sondheim tune by heart. I didn't. I was just splashing around,
mm-hmm.
clueless.
Did you sing, by the way?
I'm not. I was in choir for two semesters, and I learned enough listening to my mom give lessons that I can. I karaoke a pretty mean Sinatra, but it's about as far as it goes.
So do you audition for musicals or you don't?
I have. I've done a few musicals, but I've only had one lead role in a musical, but that's not my strong suit, and I know it. I'm not really a dancer either. I move okay. I'm coordinated, but I'm never going to go after. I focused more on the Shakespeare and the straight plays
right.
when I was in St. Louis.
Right.
So
you're a senior. You've done a lot of theater.
A lot is relative.
For yourself, no?
In college, I was involved as involved as I could be.
Right. That's what I mean. Right. And you're struggling to make this decision because apparently you are going to graduate school. It's just a question of in what.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you make the decision to do theater?
It was more a decision. I was scared. I was scared, and St. Louis felt like the big city, and I was living in Greenville, driving in for shows, and St. Louis just kept appealing to me, the more urban lifestyle, the opportunity to audition for various companies, become part of a network, part of a community. So grad school, kind of for a few years there, every year I would get all the packets. I would look at UCSD, and UW, and UT Austin, and NYU, and Columbia, and I was looking both at creative writing and at theater. But then I just kept auditioning in St. Louis, and I just kept getting cast. I was very fortunate, and I know this. I was very fortunate. There weren't a lot of me in St. Louis at that time.
You mean people like you?
Yeah, my type.
Yeah, right.
You know,
right.
Early 20s, tall, leading guy type that can also do character work.
Right.
You know, versatile.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So far you've had no training?
Only my BA at Greenville.
But you didn't have acting training, did you?
A couple acting classes and some shows, but it wasn't a conservatory. It was just a BA.
Right,
it was,
right. So far you had no real training. You're just, this is just raw talent, and mm-hmm. you're...
And just being kind of, being too dumb to know any better.
Well,
just I
don't think it was dumb, but it might have been naive.
Yes, for sure.
Right? Like,
for example, my first trip to New York City ever was a couple months ago.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. I saw my first Broadway show literally, like, 2 months ago.
Oh, my gosh. How amazing. Well, okay, all right. So
I'm in St. Louis. I'm thrashing around.
Right.
And, you know, you go to grad school to get better so you can get work. But I kept getting work.
Yeah,
so
right.
I just kept putting grad school off because I just kept... Now, I was living barely above the poverty line,
right.
You know.
But you were working.
But I was, at one point, I was working on 12 scripts at one time once. I would go to the Science Center and play a dinosaur. And then I would go rehearse a piece of Shakespeare at night. And then I would do a touring show. And then I would, you know, then I was writing just... everything I was doing was theater.
Yes.
I was living in a tiny apartment.
And you were using all of yourself, weren't you?
Yes, I just didn't know. I didn't know any better.
Right. Yeah, but it must have been very thrilling.
Yeah, I felt. Yes, it was. It was in a lifetime. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm in the big city, and I'm making my. Remember when I met my ex-wife for the first time at a show. She was in the audience, and the first time we were hanging out, flirting, and I mentioned, she's like, "What do you do?" I was like, "Well, I'm an actor." She's like, "Well, yeah, that's your hobby, but what do you do?" I was like, "No, I'm a full-time actor," and she was blown away.
Yeah.
She couldn't believe it in St. Louis.
So it was pretty remarkable, actually.
It's very rare that people make their living just through acting.
Especially when they've had no training
yes.
and they're just out of school.
Yes.
Yes.
Now, living, again, put it in quotes.
Yes, no, I understand. We're not talking here about, you know, you can't retire on this.
I was driving a car with 200,000 miles, you know, living
right.
in a one-bedroom, you know.
Right.
But I was, because of the way I was raised, again, moving so much and in a kind of religious setting and very, we never... We did a lot. We moved.
It wasn't much about
possessions.
Stuff.
I didn't care. I
yeah.
just didn't care.
Right. Right. Okay. So you keep putting off graduate school. Keep putting off graduate school.
I'm working.
School.
Yeah. yeah. And then, like I said, finally had a girlfriend for the first time, and that moved pretty quick. And you know, I wasn't from St. Louis. My plan was not to be in St. Louis long term. But you marry a St. Louis girl. St. Louis is very homey.
Mm-hmm.
It has a gravity about it. And so I sort of became from St. Louis. but at that point, too, I was very fortunate to land there as there was kind of a theater renaissance happening in St. Louis. It's a much better theater town than people realize. There is a lot of work there. Everything from the smallest little theaters, non-equity, where you make a couple $100 up to, you know, the Rep, Alort B, which is basically like the Oslo, and up to the Muni, which there's only one Muni in the country. And, you know, the Stage of St. Louis, which is a world-class musical theater where I did several shows. Shakespeare Festival St. Louis, one of the most gorgeous outdoor Shakespeare festivals in town. I mean, it all kind of just started, it kind of kicked off. I was meeting the right people. I just kept working. I was offered my equity card, turned it down the first time because I wasn't ready. My resume wasn't long enough. I knew I wouldn't work anymore. I would pick everybody's brain.
Say something about that. I've never heard anybody talk about that, because once you have an equity card, you can only work equity.
Yes.
So
it depends on the market.
Right. So what you're saying is that you could no longer get a lot of the jobs that you were now doing.
Yes. Most of my work in St. Louis was non-equity for the first couple of years.
Right. Okay.
Because I was meeting people.
Well, that's very wise, I think. I think some people would have gone for it just for the prestige of having it.
Yes.
And sacrificed the fact that they couldn't
yes.
work.
Yes.
Right.
The second time I was offered, I took it, and I was super fortunate. By that point, I worked my way up. I wasn't doing community theater anymore. That's not a disparaging remark. It's just I wasn't content there.
Mm-hmm.
People do that for a very specific reason.
And you were getting other work.
And I was getting work that paid me, that I could live on.
Right, right. Still St. Louis.
Still St. Louis, yeah. I spent about 13 years there. And I was very fortunate. But the last 5 years I was there, I was acting in 3 shows and directing 3 shows a year.
Wow.
You know, and I remember a turning point for me, Lynn, was I was at Stage of St. Louis. I was playing a small role in understudying in State Fair, which may be the worst Rodgers and Hammerstein musical ever. and all of my scenes were with this young man out of New York who had been in Miss Saigon as a swing for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember looking at him going, you are really good, but you are coming to St. Louis in the summers to get your artistic fulfillment, to play the lead roles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, yeah, it's awesome. You're on Broadway, but you've been a swing for 5 years. And that is, what I realized was that success is completely subjective. It's completely arbitrary.
Mm-hmm.
Success is what you define it. I tell my apprentices here that all the time. There's no one right path. There's no one right school. There's no one right way. And success is whatever you decide it is. And for me, doing multiple shows a year was far more fulfilling than just cashing a paycheck
mm-hmm.
for a big show.
Right.
That's one of the reasons I never got to New York. I didn't feel the need to prove myself that way. I had moments of like, what if I moved to Chicago or New York, and would I make it, and could I compete? And what became very clear as I worked at bigger and bigger theaters in St. Louis was that, yeah, absolutely I could, but I was very comfortable there. Again, I was married, had a life, I was teaching a lot.
Yeah, you had what you wanted.
Yeah, I mean, I was just like, Very much so.
Who can say that?
Yeah, very much so. I would, you know, often play a supporting role, like at the Rep or Shakespeare Festival St. Louis, make my awesome big living wage, then go play a lead role for a smaller company that was entirely fulfilling, paid less.
Right. And you were living in a community that, as you said, was homey. So it was a lot about the relationships, about the connections and the, right? So you were getting everything, really, that you seemed to have wanted.
Yeah, as a freelancer, and I would balance it. I was a visiting assistant professor, I'd do adjunct, you know, teaching paid really well. That's the track a lot of people take, is they become a professor, which is their paycheck, and then they can kind of freelance as they can in their schedule. Mm-hmm. And it's a very safe way to make a living in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
And I was applying for jobs like that. I mean, I was looking at that track as well. It was very appealing in its own way. So I very much come from the Stella Adler School, which is that I learned most of what I know from the audience.
What worked.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, while I was in St. Louis, I did continue. I did an MA in drama at Washington University.
So you did finally go to graduate school.
Yeah, I did a two-year MA at WashU in St. Louis. And then I did...
you chose theater as opposed to writing.
Oh, yes. Now, by this time, I had been working in theater so much that it wasn't even...
No, it wasn't.
And I could, and by this point, too, I had written a couple of plays that had been, I'd been commissioned, you know, so I was still writing, too.
Right.
But yeah, as far as writing the next great American novel, I'm not going to do that. That's not going to happen. I'm not going to get a story published in New York, and that's fine. I mean, I'm working on a musical right now with a writing team in New York. I mean, I'm still writing, and I love it. And then I'm the MFA in directing. Because that's the way I decide I need to go. I love acting without, you know, sounding awful. I'm very good at it. I've committed a huge chunk of my life to it. But gun to my head, I'm going to want to direct. So I got my MFA in directing there in St. Louis. In terms of like the training or regrets, I do kind of like, I wish I could have gotten the MFA somewhere else. Because the whole point of grad school really is just to meet people.
Right.
That, you know.
It's all about the connections you make there.
Yes.
All right.
And I don't really have connect. There, most of the professors there, this is not to be disparaging, they worked in their department, but didn't do any professional work outside anymore.
Right,
they were very safe.
They took that track.
And other professors are much better about, you know, understanding that doing outside work means I'm going to help my students because I have connections I can make.
Right. Well, that and the people you go to school with also, if they move on, then they become part of your...
Yep. Right. And there, it's just a thing, too, where I mean, I've been following some trends, and the academic theater is... I think it's reached a point where it's doing as much harm as it is good. Universities do not do a good job. A lot of university departments are more interested in self-perpetuation in the finances, and they are taking huge financial advantage of people who will never make enough money to pay off that tuition.
Ah.
And it becomes a thing where they're churning out so many actors and directors that there's no place for them to work. There's a glut of talent on the market, as it were.
It's very cynical.
It's not cynical. It's realistic.
It's not cynical to take people in and charge them a lot of money.
Oh, I thought you meant my point of view was cynical.
No.
No, it's kind of the university as business model as opposed to the university as educational model.
Yeah.
A lot of that
think that's cynical. I'm sorry.
It is. No, it is. if you look at university as a money-making opportunity, we got to turn a profit and build a new dorm as opposed to let's invest in these kids and make sure that they're in. I remember my undergraduate theater professor, Dr. Keener. I will thank her forever for telling me this. She sat me down at one point before I decided about grad school or what I was going to do, and she said, Jace, if you can do anything other than theater and be happy, go do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, she looked me right in the eye and just dead, and she's like, you're one of my favorite students I've had, but if you can do anything else and be happy, go do it. That's one of the reasons I love this apprentice program here and working with these young people, these early 20s people who've just graduated, because I can show them, okay, you've learned some bad habits in university. It's just going to happen. Let's undo those. Let's learn some new habits. We're not here to serve you. You're here to serve our mission with us. Now, you're going to take classes, but it's about training and improving yourself as a product, not because we're going to coddle you as our all-star student.
Yeah.
Our program is to bridge the gap from university to professional theater. And the class that most universities don't offer is just a basic how to be an independent contractor class. There should be some kind of senior year capstone. Here's how you do your taxes as an independent contractor. Here's what a resume looks like. Here's how you go. They don't teach that.
No.
Because they're only interested in... That's a huge blanket statement. I'm sure there are some universities and conservatories that do teach this stuff, whether as a class or a workshop or a seminar. But most of the people I see, most of the apprentices that apply here that we see have not had, and they ask me for it, I don't know how to do my taxes. Oh, or I don't know how to go find a job. Now I have all these skills, but how do I find the job? Because auditioning is very different than sending in a resume. It's a very different skill set. So I have empathy for, and I again, as a teacher, my thought is, if my students don't surpass me someday, I've failed them. So what can I give them? Now, hopefully they won't surpass me for a few years.
They'll leave some roles.
Right, exactly. But these people coming through here, there may be some day where, you know, Ryan or Mike or Gab, someone starts a company, and in 15 years they call me and say, I got a part for you. You know, that's entirely possible. Yeah,
right.
That's what's kind of lovely about the theater. It's right. Equal opportunity.
Right. Okay, so...
I got off on a tangent there.
It's all right. I don't mind the tangent. So it's 13 years in St. Louis.
Yes.
Right. And then what?
I kind of hit two ceilings. One ceiling I hit was the personal life took a sharp left turn.
Mm.
Got divorced. That stuff happens. The other ceiling I hit was that kind of professionally, I'd hit that place where I could keep doing the same stuff over and over, work at the same level over and over, but I wasn't breaking into the national conversation. I wasn't going to, like the Repertory Theater, they were hiring me to run their Wise Right program and to direct their children's touring show, but they weren't hiring me to direct a main stage show. The Shakespeare Festival St. Louis, I was being hired to play Banquo and Master Page, but not Master Ford or Hamlet. You know, I'd hit the...
Right.
It's the classic reason why a lot of actors keep a New York P.O. box or a New York area code so that agents and producers think they live in New York.
Yeah.
It's that grass is always greener thing. The actor you know is not as exciting as the actor who is from out of town.
Yeah, right.
There's this false idea that an actor from out of town is inherently better than the one in your backyard. It's just not true. No matter where you go. But that attitude prevails everywhere.
Yes.
So I kind of hit that point where I knew everybody,
mm-hmm.
I was producing, I was directing, I was actually running a summer stock company in Rolla, Missouri, just an hour and a half outside St. Louis. I was a producing artistic director.
Mm-hmm.
I was still a freelance actor, freelance director. I was still teaching adjunct. I still had a very nice kind of setup going on.
But it wasn't enough.
But by that point, I was like, and also just the freelance lifestyle,
mm-hmm.
it's a grind, man. It's a double-edged sword. You've got your freedom, but you don't have your stability. I hadn't had a day off in who knows how many years. You don't have a day off when you're freelance. Not really. And so because of those two things, and because all of my ex-in-laws live in St. Louis, and most of my, and I only had like one aunt and uncle out in West County, my parents had moved, my brother had moved, you know, I was just kind of there by myself. I was like, you know, I was never really playing it, you know, so I just started looking, you know. I stayed nearby because I was running the summer stock, which is a lovely little theater. Had so much fun there. I just started, you know, just cast the resumes wide. And I interviewed near Pittsburgh at a school, and I was offered a job in South Carolina, and da-da-da-da-da-da. And then a posting for this job, associate artist at FST. Two of my colleagues in St. Louis forwarded me the posting within like 8 hours of each other. James, our casting hiring director here, had sent out like kind of an email blast to a lot of mid-level artistic directors,
mm-hmm.
and two of them saw it and thought of me and forwarded it to me.
Mm.
Theater, too, you know.
That's right.
And I was like, Florida, cool.
I know.
So
Yes, exactly.
And I was sending resumes, so I just started off, and then it happened really fast with FST. I interviewed with James, and then they set me up with Richard on the phone, and then they flew me down, and I got off the plane, and I was like, I hope they offer me this job. I interviewed with everybody, and it just seemed like a really good fit all around, and when they offered it to me, I talked with some friends and family, just like there was no reason, and they were even going to let me continue to have my summer stock company. They gave me my summers off.
So and you can work here as an actor.
Yes. I was hired as an associate artist. That label is purposely kind of vague and broad, so I can do a variety of things.
Right.
So I run new play development. I teach in adult education. I run the Act and Apprentice program. I act when it's appropriate. I direct shows as appropriate. I run the new play festival. When NNPN came in here for their showcase, I was line producer on that. You know, it's just we had this little partnership, a new one with Palmetto Youth Center, where we help these kids who have never seen theater, much less done it, create an original play that they perform at the MLK banquet fundraiser. Just all these wonderful, little, awesome projects.
Mm-hmm.
So I still get the variety of freelance, but I have a paycheck and health insurance. And then when this play, Dancing Lessons, came around, just the part was such a good fit that I threw my hat in the ring with Richard and said, hey, this part is, can I have first crack? And so we'll come to that, but after I interviewed here, I was like, that they had just, they were just about ready to open the new Gompertz, and I was like, this theater is growing in the recession. They have this huge subscription base. They have small, intimate theaters, which is where I prefer to work. Mm-hmm. The mission makes sense to me. The people I met were all passionate and driven and scary talented. And Sarasota, I did my research. It's this arts cultural mecca of Florida. It's like this jewel. And then, of course, the beaches and the lifestyle. I was like, okay. So when they offered it, I was like, there's no reason not to. You know, even if it ends up being a bust, at least I'm out of St. Louis and trying and forwarding mm-hmm. my personal path in some way.
Right.
And I was down here about 2 months, and I was like, I don't think I will ever leave the Gulf Coast. St. Pete is awesome. Tampa's awesome. I mean, everything. I mean, just there's so much in Oslo, the opera, the ballet, the jazz, the film festival, the restaurants. I mean, it's just like, I can't. What I kept telling my parents was that I didn't know people were allowed to live like this. And the weather. And then my parents moved to Lakeland 6 months later, so there and I would have a way, which is perfect. But yeah, so that's the story of how I got to here. And I've been here just over 2 years, and I love it.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're preaching to the converted here. So okay.
So dancing lessons.
Yeah.
So Mark St. Germain, who we have a wonderful relationship with, he's been in residency with us a couple times the last few years. We've done several of his shows. He was commissioned by Barrington, where he's like a resident artist, to write a new show, Dancing Lessons. And he was here for a residency last January, a year ago. And so as part of his 3 weeks here, I put together about 4 or 5 table reads of his various scripts so that we could hear them out loud to see which ones we were interested in, so he could hear them out loud to do tweaks.
Mm-hmm.
And Dancing Lessons was still in an earlier stage. And I set up a table reading in this very room, actually, right there, here in Studio A. And I was casting people from the various shows we had. And so I'm here in the room with Priscilla and Richard and Mark. And my guy actor, who I cast to play ever, doesn't show up. We got our wires crossed. He had it on a different day.
Oh.
And I couldn't get him on the phone. And so Tim and Richard's like, just read it. So I end up reading it, like, cold, on the fly. And Richard loved it. And Mark loved it. And it was a part that just made a lot of sense to me. It was, as an actor, you learn some parts just slip on like a perfectly fitted jacket. This is one of those. I was not brought here to be an actor, but as an associate artist, they plugged me in where I'm going to best benefit the theater, and the part was such that when the new play festival came up, Richard said, get Priscilla back, you two do this show as part of the new play festival. I'm like, okay. So I direct and act in the new play festival reading of Dancing Lessons last May, where, again, Mark just got, he was just so thrilled with what he learned about the play from us doing it, and we fell in love with the play even more. Now, because he was commissioned by Barrington, they got the world premiere just like 3 or 4 months ago,
mm-hmm.
but we locked up the rights immediately for our slot, and before I left for the summer, because I still had my summer slot last year, that's finished now, but before I left for the summer, I told Richard, if we do this play, I want first crack. He's like, okay. So I'm gone, don't hear. I get back, my first meeting with Richard, I come in August, I'm like, hey, and he's like, how was the summer, great, oh, we're doing Dancing Lessons, can I audition? He's like, oh, you're doing the part. I'm like, oh, okay. He's like, just very flippantly, just, you're doing it. I'm like, great. So yeah.
So I'm just curious, did it change much from the reading?
It's changed a lot. Now, not in the sense of huge scenes being rewritten. Mark is such a good writer. He'll, like, do a small change that dominoes through the rest of the script.
Can you give an example?
Man, I've read like, literally 5 versions of the script, and then we kept getting new rewrites during our rehearsal process. The biggest change in the play was made in the character of Senga, who my scene partner Vanessa is playing. The earliest draft back in January was very much an ever showcase. It was his play, and she was only the straight man, pretty much. You know, she was broken, she was not really fully fleshed out. And what kept happening is that, because Ever is such an immediately lovable, recognizable, funny, charming, endearing character, is that he had to pump up Senga to match him truly. In a two-person play, they have to be evenly matched. So he bumped up a lot of the empathy for her, you know, the way she had the injury, the way she interacted with him.
All that stuff with her ex, or that was always
that was it? Yeah, that was the biggest change, and this happened relatively late in the process, is that the entire story of how her father died completely changed. Completely changed.
Wow.
Because Mark had heard the story, because the original version was a true story he heard from a woman, and when this woman, his friend, saw the play, it was so powerful that she said, I can't, you can't, she asked him to redact it. because it was just too, she felt too exposed.
Wow.
So he completely rewrote Senga's backstory, basically.
Wow.
And what he came up with is actually, I think, in a way, even better. But yeah, that kind of stuff. And he, you know, for Mark, changing a word here or there, or changing a sequence, or cutting a joke here, or altering a joke there. I mean, a joke can go from amusing to hilarious with the turn of one comma or one word. And he's really good at fine-tuning like that. And he was great about listening to us in rehearsal, too. He would send us notes. We would try things. We'd send him suggestions back, like, this actually was better in my mouth, or this played better this way. He's like, great, keep it. He's so open and humble about it.
Okay, so I want to talk to you about this part.
Sure.
Well, there are a couple of things I want to ask about. You inhabit it so completely.
Oh, thank you.
That it made me wonder if it was difficult to take him off.
No, here... Funny story, this goes all the way back to high school. I remember in high school, one of my first roles, it was a play written by one of our senior students, and I played an abusive father, mm-hmm. an abusive alcoholic father, and the son in the play was actually my brother. and that was one where I thought, you know, theater, oh, it's, you know, you got to get into character, and it's magic, and, you know, you got to carry it with you everywhere, and I would, like, leave rehearsal just feeling down on myself and angry and kind of dirty, and there came a point where I was like, this is just not healthy. This is just
I don't
not
like
healthy.
This.
And like I pointed out, there's such a strong kind of math part of my mind, too, which is like, well, how do you fix that? How do you deal with that? You know, and so for me, I don't view acting as a magical thing. I don't become someone else. What acting does is it allows me to show more of myself. Ever is a conduit through which for Jason to express Jason. Always honoring the character and the intent and the plot and what the playwright's trying to do. But it's not that I'd stop becoming Jason. All I have is my body, my flesh, my blood, my voice, my eyes, my hair. I can't change that stuff. What I tell my apprentices all the time is if all 12 of you played Hamlet with integrity, they would all be completely different and completely right. So as far as taking Ever off, no, that is not difficult. The show ends and it's like, oh, that was a ride. We had Vanessa and I have so much fun. And we always have a little moment off stage. As soon as we exit the curtain call, we give each other a big old hug and high five. And we have a little moment of what happened. This, you know, we talk for maybe like 20 seconds about what happened in the show just to check in.
The chemistry is wonderful.
We're very good friends. The casting is so tricky in a small play like this.
Uh-huh.
Especially when it's romantic comedy, the chemistry is everything.
Right.
And, my trip to New York, first time ever, was for auditions for that part. We saw Vanessa up in New York, and that's where I first met her.
Oh,
was up there.
Wow.
But yes, very, very wonderful, fortunate chemical bond that we have.
Yes.
But forever, I'm also very much, you might hear people talk about outside in versus inside out acting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very much outside in. So doing a character like this that is built so much in behaviors,
yes,
is actually, again, that's why it fits so well. Because
yeah,
I understand.
This is how Richard does it too.
I understand, yes,
right.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Building the character like a mason or, you know, building a house, and you fill in the gaps and it's from the ground up. And it's not that I have to feel something first, it's that I have to behave. Action often leads to emotion. Emotions are just chemicals and neurons firing. Emotions are literally physiological. You smile, you feel happier. You frown, you feel angrier. You have an immediate emotional reaction, and the physical reaction happens at the same time, if not before, the chemical reaction. Think about how if you're cut off in traffic, the rage is instant. It's insta-rage. Right? So I am not one who's a proponent of capital M method acting.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's not about having to feel, because I do 8 shows a week. I can't feel it. It's just not going to, it's not humanly possible to truly feel it every time. Now, my job is to create an environment in which the audience can experience the emotions every time. Their cathartic experience matters far more than mine. My cathartic experience happens in rehearsal. That's where we discover that's how that moment works. Now, the job of the actor is to replicate that. Not my feeling, but to replicate the behaviors, the shapes, the sounds, so that that emotion can happen for the first time in whoever is watching the show. So that's
it's real interesting. I mean, I know that this is how Richard feels about it as
yes.
well. So it's just serendipitous that mm-hmm. yeah, right?
Okay, like I said, that's why when I got here, I feel like I
fit. Yeah, you found home, right.
Now, we still are, because again, there's Richard, but the director of this play was Kate.
Right.
She works from the heart all the time.
She's
very earth mother, and just it is all
right,
the
right,
feeling
right,
is
right, that's right.
The feeling and the breath are far more important. I mean, she'll use the word emotion all the time, and Richard uses the word action all the time. Now, if I had to pick a side, I'd pick Richard's, but Kate's way of working is just as valid, and she challenged me in ways that I've not been challenged. You know, every direct, you learn something new from every director. And if anything, working here at FST, I've learned more from Kate in that, in terms of how to get emotion out of my young actors, because I already spoke Richard's language. I'm learning Kate's
language. That's right.
Still.
That's right. I got it. There's another thing I wanted to ask you about, and I'm going to get a chance to interview Mark, I think, and I'm...
Oh, great. Fantastic.
Yes, and I want to ask him as well. The scene where you guys dance as though there's nothing wrong with you?
That's another example of something that changed in the script. The original back in January, that whole scene, they actually kind of danced off behind a big sign and changed and it came out. And he simplified it, and now it just happens right there with some light.
Right, and it's fine. Awesome. It's yes. fine.
It still
it's
reads,
absolutely
still
right.
Still reads completely clean.
Right.
But those are the kind of tweaks, to just jump back a little bit, those are the kind of tweaks you just kept making.
Well, okay. I have one more question,
sure.
And it is, having given a life since high school to this work, is there anything that you would say about what it's like to have done that?
I'll answer you with a story.
Okay.
Because I'm a theater. in St. Louis, I fell in love with the play Doubt.
Mm-hmm.
I read it. I was just like, this play's great. And I was shopping around the theater saying, I want to direct this for you. Can I direct this for you? I want to direct this for you. And I had a colleague, Kim, who was starting a brand new theater company. And she wanted to do that play as her premiere play. It's her debut. And she called me and said, Jason, I want you to play the part of Father Flynn. And I was like, I've been trying to shop. I want to direct it. She's like, well, do both. I'm like, you sure? She's like, yeah. I'm like, okay. So I ended up doing Doubt, being the director and the actor, which worked out great because it was a short play. Half his scenes are monologues anyway and sermons, so there's going to be a play to direct yourself in. It's a good candidate. And I immediately called three of my favorite people in St. Louis, Anna, who'd been one of my, who directed me before in grad school, and I was a teacher, Edward, who was a director and production manager at The Rep, and Stephen Wolf, who was the artistic director of The Rep. And I scheduled them to come in throughout the process, and that's just like, just note me to death, please.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what you see. So this process happens. They all come in. They're all so generous. And the play just does far better than, I mean, at that point, the Kevin Kline Awards were still around. It got nominated for everything, you know, production, direction, actor, actress, even cast. And very fortunately, I ended up winning Best Actor in a Play that year.
Oh.
Even better, I tied with my good friend John Contini. We both won. It was awesome. I got right backstage and just picked him up in a bear hug. It was great. Anyway, this is very similar to the speech I gave when I received my award, is the story that happened. During all of my dramaturgical prep work for the show, you know, the big question of Doubt, if you don't know the play, is a question of what did this priest do or not do? And you leave not knowing what he did. Is the point.
Right.
And I had done all this work, and I had come up with what I thought was a really good theory that had lots of evidence in the text. And I had heard through the grapevine, through various friends, that John Patrick Shanley, the playwright, was very approachable. He left his email and his bios. He had a Facebook page. He friended everybody. He was very approachable. So I spent about an hour one day writing this email to John Patrick Shanley, outlining my theory. It was like I was writing a term paper. Like, I'm writing John Patrick Shanley, Pulitzer-winning dramatist.
I'm telling him what I think
and
that he meant.
They had just made the movie, and I had heard that he had pulled Philip Seymour Hoffman aside to tell him what the truth was. You know, so I was like, here's my theory, and what do you think? Sent it off, expecting I'd never hear back. 5 minutes later, ping, I get a response from John Patrick Shanley from his phone. And this is word for word what he said. He said, Jason, play whatever backstory you want. Have fun with it, John. That was all he said.
Yeah,
and my first reaction was like, I spent an hour, that's all I did. And I was like, you know what, actually, it was such a lesson in humility and grace for someone of his ilk to respond to some guy in St. Louis doing a little SPT production of his play, for him just to say, whatever backstory you want. As an artist, as a playwright, to just basically say, and this is what I told the audience, the playwright gave the play away to me as a director. Just gave it away. No strings attached. As a director, then, it is my job to give that play away to the actors. Yeah, first day of rehearsal, I know the most. By the first day of opening, they know far more than I do. And then it is the actor's job to give that play away, that experience, to the audience. And only then do you have theater. So when you ask me kind of what is it like to have devoted, 21, 22 years of my life to this particular art form, it's about the audience. It is about giving away as much as possible. For me, yes, I explore, I find truth. I'm not religious anymore, but I find as much sacredness and holiness in the theater as I ever did in church. And just the experience, the saying the same words when I played Hamlet once, and to repeat those words that have been spoken by tens of thousands of people for the last 5 centuries, to share in that, to realize it's not about me, that doing theater, the last person I'm concerned with is myself. It's one of the reasons why I love living near the water. The smaller I am, the more I feel like I'm actually serving the story, serving the audience. We are a creature as humans that crave narrative. We find truth in story. And to even just be a small part of that. And then here too, to work with the kids to see if, when we do under six, and to see a third grader write a perfect 2-page play, there is just nothing sweeter in the world than to watch that child and his parents, or her brother, to watch them watch his play being performed by professional actors, to watch their reaction, to watch a father look at his son transform in real time as he watches this play that his kid wrote.
So it's a lot about service for you.
It has to be. Otherwise you're an artiste or an auteur or a diva, and I have no patience for that. If I'm not serving something greater than myself, what is the point? Because if it's not bigger than me, then what's the point?
I got it.
I feel like there's a better way to say that, but that's all I've got.
I don't think that there's a better way to say that.
So,
and I think it's a great place to stop.
Well, awesome.
So thank you very much, Jason.
Thank you.
Come out and see him. He's extraordinary. The play is extraordinary. It is, it's really life-altering, I think, to see. So,
it challenges what Mark has done so well with the play, is that it challenges the notion of what normal means. And you learn such empathy for people and their various injuries or obstacles.
Yes.
Do they really get healed? Well, yes and no.
Does it matter?
Does it matter? Yeah. just the fact that you are seen, is
yes.
that enough?
Come out and find your own answer. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you, Lynn, very much.
Well, I hope that you heard what I hear when I talk to Jason, and that is the complete absorption with the work that he does. Everything that he does brings him the joy of being who he really is. He can actually even say at the end of this interview that if he isn't doing what he's doing, if he's not serving with this work that is so integral to him, so important to him, then he can't think of the point. So are you saying that about your life? That what you're doing is so important that without that you wouldn't know what the point of your life was? That's what we're looking for. That's at least what I'm looking for in every life, the complete identification with that life. This is the point of my being here. This is who I am. I am the expression of myself. And this may not be true, but it is what I believe, that when you are the complete expression of yourself, you are in fact doing service, because you are role modeling what it is like to be completely and wholly in touch with your basic, essential self. So, that is what the Lynn Show is hoping to communicate. And And as I said at the beginning, I interview people like Jason who make their living or their life within art because they do. They demonstrate it in a way that no explanation or words could possibly do. So, if you want to listen to this interview again, or if you want to hear any of my other interviews, or if you want to ask me a question, or you want to talk to me, or you want to get me to talk to your group or organization, or you want to read my book, or listen to my CD, you can get all of that on my website, thelynnshow.com. That is T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E, don't leave the E out of Lynn, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E-S-H-O-W, thelynnshow.com. And as always, I hope that you got something that you can use from this show. Something that inspired you, something that intrigued you, some piece of information you didn't have, but now that you do, something that reminded you, something that'll bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have got to